I will call to order this fourth remote meeting of the House Commerce Committee. Mr. Brown, would you take the roll?
Chair Stevenson.
Present.
Vice Chair Cotizza-Witum.
Present.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Here.
Representative Barr.
Here.
Representative Carlson.
Here.
Representative Dabney.
Present.
Representative Elkins.
Present.
Representative Haley.
Here.
Representative Cagle.
Present.
Representative Lee.
Lee present.
Representative Lilly. Representative Lislegard.
Here.
Representative Lucero.
Yes, sir.
Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Present.
Representative Rasmussen.
Present.
Representative Richardson.
Present.
Representative Tice. Representative
present.
Tice. Thank you. And I will call again Representative Lilly. All right.
A quorum is present. Pardon me? Someone?
No, okay. Mr. Chair, I'll move the approval of the minutes from the last meeting.
Okay, Representative Elkins moves the minutes. Any discussion to the motion? Hearing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Today's agenda is another in our series of informational hearings on the areas that the Commerce Committee has jurisdiction over. We will be looking at telecommunications today, as well as getting a presentation from House Research on Minnesota's liquor laws. Just for the committee's benefit, looking ahead to next week, we will have one more overview hearing on Tuesday. We will be looking at gaming laws in Minnesota. And then I anticipate that we will take up bills starting next Wednesday. But as I mentioned, our first area that we will be looking at today is our Minnesota's telecommunications landscape. And our first testifier is Brent Christensen of the Minnesota Telecom Alliance. Mr. Christensen?
Okay, it helps on mute. Good morning, Mr. Chair, or good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brent Christensen. I'm the president and CEO of the Minnesota Telecom Alliance. We're a trade association that represents independent telecommunications companies in Minnesota. I am going to hopefully share my screen and go through a few slides, if that's all right. Just for a fact check, can everybody see my slides? Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome. So as I said, I represent 42 broadband providers that serve rural Minnesota. Our members range from CenturyLink is our largest member, and we have one telecom company that has 233 subscribers in South Central Minnesota. It's basically all of the traditional landline telephone companies except for Frontier and Windstream. And our members are a mix of cooperatives, family-owned companies, and commercial companies, both publicly traded and privately held. Who we aren't is we don't do cellular service. Our members don't do that. And we are not mobile VoIP providers like Vonage or MagicJack. Our MTA members have transitioned over the last 20 years from being predominantly landline telephone companies to rural broadband providers. We deploy our services in a variety of ways. Obviously, our choice is to do fiber to the premise, so we build fiber all the way to the customer. We also do fiber to the node, which means we'll build fiber to a cabinet in an area, in a neighborhood or a rural area, and then we'll reuse the copper plant, the telephone lines that were in the ground already. And then as we transition out of those, then we move towards closer to the fiber to the prem. The theory is that the closer you get the customer to the central office, the more bandwidth you can get to them. So the closer we can get them to fiber, the more bandwidth we're going to be able to get to them. There are some areas in rural Minnesota that are conducive to doing fixed wireless, and so we will do that as well, either on a licensed or an unlicensed basis. But that's where we put an antenna up on a tower, and then we beam a signal directly to the consumer's home. And it's a little different cellular, so it's not a mobile technology. It's a point to point. I like to tell people that we put the wire in wireless. The only thing wireless in cellular service goes from the tower to the handset. The rest of it uses the traditional network. This is the same thing, except there's not a mobility factor in this. I'd like to talk a little bit about how we're regulated, since that really falls in the purview of this committee. And I'm going to talk about it from two different standpoints. First, about how we're regulated by our versus our competitors, and then how we're regulated by the different lines of business that we have. Let me preface that by saying telecommunications and all the presenters today on telecommunications, we're part of the industry. And unlike gas and electric, we are the only competitive utility. There is no competition in electric. There's no competition in gas. There is competition in telecommunications. We are, for the traditional telephone companies, both the incumbents and then the competitors, we're regulated by the Public Utilities Commission, by the Department of Commerce, by the Office of the Attorney General, and the FCC. The wireless carriers, the cellular companies that will be presenting later, they're regulated by the FCC. And then the voice over internet, or as you probably heard, VoIP technology, is regulated lightly by the FCC as an information service, not really a telecommunication service. This slide talks about how we're regulated by the different lines of business. My members basically have three lines of business that they're involved. We still have some landline, traditional landline, or we call it POTS, plain old telephone service. That's regulated by the Public Utilities Commission, by the Department of Commerce, and the Attorney General. Most of my members do traditional TV, you'd know it as cable TV or IPTV. That's regulated by the FCC and by local franchise agreements, either with a city or a township. And then the internet side of our business is regulated by the FCC. So where does that leave us as an industry? And we've really made a change over the last 20 years. It used to be that the internet went over the telephone lines. Well, now it's voice goes over the internet. And that's really kind of the technology shift that's happened. And the honest truth is that we're regulated by the state really only on our landline telephone business. And that's becoming a smaller and smaller part of our business every year. I will tell you, I come from the industry. My family has a company in South Central Minnesota. At our high point, we had 1,832 access lines. So we had 1,832 different telephone numbers or different landlines out there. Now we're down to under 800. So we've seen a dramatic drop in the landline telephone business. And quite frankly, had we not gotten into the internet business, we wouldn't be in business. The bottom line is that consumers care more about what the state does not regulate, broadband and wireless, versus the things that they do regulate, which is the wireline telephone business. So, Mr. Chairman, that's really kind of a short synopsis of it. I really would like to answer questions and take this in the direction that the members would like to go. So with that, I will end my testimony and stand for questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Christensen, and we will definitely have a period for members to ask questions. I like to make sure we get all the testimony in first. So if you would be willing to stay on the line until we get through all the testimony, then we'll let the members ask questions. And members, as usual, you can raise your hand at any time, and then we will field questions at the end of the presentation. But first, I'm still getting used to this remote hearing business and having a second screen over here with my agenda on it. And I glanced over in a very important item on that agenda, which is House Research was going to give us a five-minute overview of telecom laws. So my very deepest apologies to Mr. Eliff, who's on the line, and we'll go to him next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. Members, my summary will be a short one, largely due to the fact that, as Mr. Christensen has already mentioned, The state has authority to regulate a relatively narrow slice of the operations of telecommunications companies. And I'll focus my remarks on three areas: telephone, cable TV, and internet. A generation ago, telephone companies were regulated like any other utility, the way energy companies continue to be regulated today, and by the same entity, the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. Their prices were directly regulated by the PUC. Companies had to submit tariffs to the commission for each type of service that they offered, and the tariffs and the prices at which those services were offered to customers had to receive PUC approval before they became effective. General rate cases were held that delved deeply into the intricate details of the company's financial operations in order for these pricing decisions to be made by the commission, and those often lasted months. But then the cell phone arrived and rapidly became popular, diminishing the number, both the proportion and the absolute number of landlines. In 1993, Congress preempted state authority over cell phone rates, the rationale being that since the Federal Communications Commission was responsible for both licensing and allocating the spectrum on which cell phones operated, the federal government was the logical entity to regulate the new technology, thus avoiding a patchwork of state regulation. So to this day, the state really doesn't regulate very directly cell phones, as Mr. Christensen mentioned. But traditional price regulation for landline phones continued in Minnesota for another two decades. In 2014, the legislature enacted a law effectively deregulating most landlines. A mere handful of local exchange areas didn't meet the criteria to attain deregulation at that time. Basically, 60% of subscribers in an area can choose a voice service from a competitor. So at this point, what's left of telephone regulation at the state level? These companies still have to abide by a number of what I call consumer protection type statutes, those that prohibit discrimination, deceptive practices, and fraud, those that prohibit companies from impairing the speed or quality of their delivered services. Companies are also prohibited from switching customers to another carrier without the customer's permission, an activity known as slamming. And they're also prohibited from charging customers for services that the customers did not request, even if if they allow a third party to do so. That's an activity known as cramming. Companies must also participate in the state's 911 program, the telephone assistance program, which provides a $7 discount to low-income customers from their monthly bill. The Telephone Assistance Minnesota program, which provides essentially hardware and in some cases live operators to help persons with disabilities to use phones. The PUC does retain authority to investigate a telephone company's operations if it believes that a violation of state law may have occurred. And the state, but not the PUC, has also developed statutory guidelines regarding right-of-way issues, as in legislation that governed the advent of 5G in 2017. There is a small lone vestige of price regulation that remains for what is called basic local services, which is single line voice service, essentially your grandfather's telephone. Since 2018, rates have not been allowed to increase for that service by more than $2 a month. There's a $25 cap in effect until 2022. But after that point, these price controls disappear, although the PUC can do an investigation to see if resulting rates will, quote, cause substantial customer harm. As far as cable TV is concerned, unlike with telephone, PUC never had authority over prices with respect to cable, and they still don't. Existing state statutes address the process by which a cable company must seek a franchise to operate, and it must do that in every city in which it operates. And it also governs what must be part of a franchise application, what types of ordinances those cities must have regarding cable TV. These statutes also regulate the sale or transfer of franchises and require companies to have a process to address complaints and also deal with physical access issues for cable TV installation. And finally, the internet. The PUC does not regulate the internet. And although there's some scope for state authority, you may have heard about a few states enacting what are called net neutrality laws in the past few years. There's little of this type of regulation in Minnesota. Regulation is like the federal level
as well. Despite the FCC's reclassification of the internet as a public utility in 2015 and its adoption at the federal level of net neutrality rules, these actions were overturned by the Trump administration a few years later. So that's kind of the 50,000 foot overview of what regulation of telecommunications are in Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Eliff. Appreciate that and appreciate your flexibility on timing there. Next testifier will be Dana Bailey of Lumen. Ms. Bailey.
Hi, everyone. It is so good to see everybody, even virtually. I am going to share my screen here for my presentation. Can everybody see that?
We are not seeing it.
Oh, hang on.
There,
sorry. Okay, great. All right. So thank you for taking the time to talk through telecom today. My name is Dana Bailey, and I am the State and Local Government Affairs Director for Lumen, formerly known as CenturyLink. I think the last time I was in front of Commerce, I was talking about Minlars, so I promise this won't be as painful. But I am grateful for the opportunity to talk about telecom. And, you know, I can't really do that without a brief explanation of our rebrand. So I think of us as a technology company with a telecom heritage. And under the Lumen name, our team support multiple brands. We've got Lumen serving mostly enterprise, Quantum Fiber serving our small businesses and homes, and of course the CenturyLink brand still serving our residential and small business customers. But our evolution over the last 50 years has allowed us to build one of the world's largest global fiber networks with 450,000 route miles of fiber, delivering one of the fastest, most secure platforms to enable enterprise to quickly embrace emerging technology that reshapes their business and delivers on innovation. The same fiber also enables us to deliver the speed, bandwidth, and reliability necessary for small business and residential customers to work, learn, and live in our new normal. The Lumen platform is a result of all of our network assets. Along with the fiber I just mentioned, we also have over 2,200 data centers for dynamic connections to cloud providers and over 6,400 internet autonomous systems connected, making Lumen one of the deepest peered IP networks in the world. The best way that all of this was explained to me, though, is that one third of the world's internet traffic touches our network every day. But in telecom, we've been challenged. After the Telecom Act of 96 opened up the market to all voice competitors, progress in voice technology continued to accelerate. Today, competitive options for voice service include wireless, fixed wire, rural electric, cable, VoIP, and coming soon to a low Earth orbit near you, satellite voice technology. So it's no wonder plain old telephone service got passed up by the competition on the national level 5 years ago. Here in Minnesota, Lumen has lost 77% of our copper switched wire lines. And this loss continues at an average of 10 to 15% a year. According to CDC data that we track on an annual basis, just 4.4% of Minnesota households are wireline only. And we can't talk about telecom without talking about broadband, because that's part of the Lumen story too. In the last 3 years, we have invested $200 million in broadband in the state. We employ nearly 2,000 Minnesotans. Over half of them are members of the Communications Workers of America. And we're competitive in broadband because of our fiber. And our ongoing investment will be primarily in this technology. Where we're able, we'll transition copper to fiber, and we'll continue our efforts to close that digital divide through our federal, state, and local partnerships. but it's important for us to start the conversation with all of you this session about our desire to modify Minnesota's century-old telecom statute, regulating the copper-switched wireline. Our modifications would do a couple of things. First, they would recognize that competition for voice services in Minnesota are ubiquitous. This is something that the PUC determined back in 2015 in all but 1,500 households in the state. These modifications would also recognize that any discontinuance of copper is done through a process with the FCC that will continue to hold the public harmless. Knowing the chair's desire for consensus, we'll continue to reach out and schedule time with all of you, along with our partners and stakeholders, to discuss our effort. And I am glad to respond to questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Bailey. And I don't know if you were in the room when I mentioned this. We'll be doing all the testimony first, and then we'll do questions. So if you could just stay on the line, and then we'll
we'll
do questions.
You bet.
The next testifier is Patrick Fusick of T-Mobile.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much. On behalf of our almost 600 employees located in Minnesota, I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to present comments on behalf of T-Mobile to the committee. My name is Patrick Fusick, and I am the Director of Government Affairs for T-Mobile in our Midwest region, which includes Minnesota and about 13 other states. I look forward to working with you all on any issues that come before the committee dealing with communication services in the coming session. I want to point out that T-Mobile is represented by our contract lobbyist, Peter Coyle, and his team with the Larkin Hoffman firm. Brief background on myself, I've got 32 years of experience working in state government affairs. That includes 22 years with Sprint and 10 years working for state government in Illinois. I previously covered Minnesota for Sprint. It's been about 8 or so years, so look forward to getting reacquainted with members and getting back to covering the state. As you likely know, Sprint and T-Mobile completed our merger last year, and the new company, T-Mobile, is now the second largest wireless carrier in the United States. And highlights from that merger include a nearly $40 billion investment in our network over the first 3 years to bring the company into the 5G era and to meet FCC enforceable commitments on our network build-out. Those commitments include, in that first 3 years, we will cover 97% of the U.S. population with 5G on low-band spectrum and 79% of the population with 5G on mid-band spectrum. That will grow to 99% of the population covered with low-band 5G in 6 years and 88% with mid-band 5G. In the rural areas, there are specific rural commitments. Those commitments include covering 85% of rural America with 5G low band spectrum in 3 years and 55% of that population with mid band 5G. That will grow to 90% of the rural population on low band in 6 years and 67% of that population on mid band 5G. As the 5G network is built out, the speed and capacity gains will be significant. T-Mobile's 5G network, which already covers more than 250 million people in the U.S., will deliver high-speed wireless broadband with speeds in excess of 100 megabytes per second to nearly two-thirds of the U.S. population by the end of this year and to almost 90% of the population by 2024. And all of this is made possible because of this unique combination of spectrum assets that we deployed across the country. Basically, it's more cell sites with more accelerating the deployment of those cell sites with unencumbered spectrum for 5G deployment. This complementary spectrum portfolio includes a combination of low band, mid band, and high band spectrum that offers options for wide area coverage and high capacity at the same time. Specifically in Minnesota, 80% of our approximately 1,500 network sites are now provisioned for 5G coverage, with the majority of those providing 5G low band, and with extended coverage, and the rest with 5G mid band with ultra capacity. Obviously, this network commitment came before the pandemic arrived, and since last March, our network has performed at peak levels, allowing us to handle the additional demands placed on that network with our remote work and educational requirements that we all are facing. Another merger commitment is a program called 10 million, where we, a project 10 million, where we have committed to provide free hotspots to 10 million qualifying low-income K through 12 students in order to provide internet access to their homes. This program was established again before the onset of the pandemic, but timing could not have been more crucial with the pandemic requiring remote learning for students across the country. And we have provided 2 million hotspots to students across the nation to date in that program. Also in Minnesota, T-Mobile has provided 2,060 hotspots to students in 33 school districts under Project 10 Million in just the last 5 months. And prior to that, we had a program called Empower Ed, which we had assisted 12,500 low-income students with free connectivity in over 100 school districts in the state. So combined, these two programs have provided connectivity for 14,500 low-income students with internet connectivity that we are proud to be a partner making a difference in those students' lives. Lastly, one more benefit of the combined merger is a program called Connecting Heroes, where we are providing free unlimited service to first responder agencies across the country. T-Mobile is pledging $7.7 billion over 10 years so that the first responders in police, fire, and EMT departments that face tough budget decisions will not have to make decisions between crucial equipment and wireless services. I'll be happy to answer any questions at the appropriate time, Mr. Chairman, on that. I just will make one more note. Like I said, I didn't cover you all when you did the 5G bill. I just want to commend the legislature for passing the small cell 5G bill. That has been really helpful to us in deploying our network in Minnesota, and it helps you all obviously keep up with your neighbors in some of the surrounding states that have passed similar legislation. Just wanted to point that out. And again, thank you for the opportunity to present comments and open for questions at the appropriate time.
Thank you very much. Our thank next you. Testifier is Paul Wirtz of AT&T.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and members of the House Commerce Committee. I'm Paul Wirtz. I'm the state president for AT&T Minnesota. I represent nearly 1,300 employees in our state. We're very proud of our more than 100-year history in Minnesota. I should also point out that I've served as a member of the Governor's Broadband Task Force since 2015. AT&T is proud of our network investments in Minnesota. At a time when technology is proving to be even more essential for communication, AT&T customers can be rest assured that our company is continuing to invest in our network and new technologies to make connection easier. Let me share with you some information about our network experience in this era of the COVID pandemic. In the U.S., internet traffic carried by AT&T rose almost immediately 20% at the start of the pandemic in mid-March. By the end of April, network traffic was up 25% from our typical Monday to Friday periods and showed no signs of fading. The surge in traffic on the internet as a whole and on our part of the network is extraordinary, and that citing a 20% increase does not do it justice. Our network carries an extra 71 petabytes of data every day. 1 petabyte is 1 million gigabytes. Back in 2014, our total network traffic was 56 petabytes a day. We now carry more new traffic every day than our total daily traffic 6 years ago. The peak backbone of traffic used to be Saturday and Sunday nights. Families don't go out on Sunday nights. They stay home and watch videos, movies, sports. But with so many people working at home during the pandemic, we see the equivalent of Sunday nights on multiple days of the week. For example, on Easter Sunday, we saw 23,000 text messages per minute, which was 8,000 more text messages than their previous record from New Year's Eve the previous year. This is why ongoing investment in our network is imperative, and that's what we're doing here in Minnesota. From 2017 to 2019, AT&T invested more than $300 million in our Minnesota wireless network. And from 2010 to 2019, we've invested more than $1 billion in that network. We're the largest investor in America's economy, investing $125 billion over the past 5 years in wired and wireless services. Last year in Minnesota, our company made almost 2,000 network enhancements across the state, including new cell sites, additional network capacity, network upgrades, and small cells. Those 2,000 network investments in 2020 include 27 new cell sites, 38 new small cells, 16 in-building projects to enhance wireless coverage indoors, including 10 hospitals and medical facilities, and over 1,600 projects to add network capacity. We launched AT&T 5G nationwide in 2020, including communities across Minnesota, from Worthington to St. Cloud to the Twin Cities to Bemidji, among others. We're also making great progress in our commitment to FirstNet, the only nationwide high-speed broadband communications platform for America's first responders and public safety. Those 2,000 network enhancements in Minnesota in 2020 also included almost 300 projects to add Band 14 spectrum to existing sites. Band 14 is the nationwide high-quality spectrum set aside for government for FirstNet. We've also launched a FirstNet cell sites in Minnesota, including Zirkle and Graceville, one of 23 that we committed to build for the state as part of the FirstNet opt-in process. And we have construction underway on a new purpose-built FirstNet cell site in Minnesota, one of the first primarily powered by solar in the Midwest. This site is located on the Echo Trail north of Ely in Orr. The remote site was identified by state and public safety stakeholders as a priority location for increased network coverage and capacity to better support emergency communications. Minnesota's first responders deserve reliable coverage across the state to help them effectively and efficiently address incidents. And with this FirstNet network, that's exactly what they're getting. In addition to our network, we're also proud of our investment in Minnesota's communities. Our company is committed to giving back to local communities through our giving programs, community outreach, and employee volunteerism. In Minnesota, from 2017 to 2019, we invested more than $2.9 million in Minnesota through our foundation employees and corporate contributions. Through our AT&T Believes program, we've also been focused on creating positive change in our local communities. In Minnesota, we launched the Believe Twin Cities Initiative focused on helping those experiencing homelessness and hunger. Since 2019, we've donated $200,000 through AT&T and our foundation to local organizations helping those face homelessness or hunger in Minnesota. Organizations like Union Gospel in St. Paul, the Salvation Army, and People Serving People in Minneapolis. We've also made it a priority to support economic empowerment through Believe Twin Cities. In 2020, we donated $150,000 to local nonprofits who shared our mission to create economic opportunities and paths for success to underserved communities. Last year, we also expanded our Believes program to Duluth. A $10,000 contribution from AT&T will help the Duluth Harbor Mission support the city's growing homeless population. We're proud to do our part to give back and improve the communities where we serve and our employees work and live. And with that, Mr. Chair, I thank the committee and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. And then our last testifier is Daniel Lightfoot of the League of Minnesota Cities. Mr. Lightfoot.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. I will share my screen here. And hopefully everybody can see that. We see that, Mr. Chair?
Well, yes, I'm sorry. I should have confirmed. Yes.
Fantastic. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Daniel Lightfoot, and I serve as an intergovernmental relations representative with the League of Minnesota Cities, where I cover telecommunications issues for our 835 member cities across the state of Minnesota. And the League of Minnesota Cities' mission is promoting excellence in local government through effective advocacy, expert analysis, and trusted guidance for all Minnesota cities. And in the telecom space, that guidance includes technical assistance, model ordinances, and lease agreements, and assistance with interpreting federal and state rules and law when it comes to telecom. And we can't talk about telecommunications and cities without considering the public right of way. Much of what a city considers when dealing with telecom deployment is infrastructure that service providers seek to place in the right of way. And that right of way includes the street, areas supporting the street, such as sidewalks, shoulders, ditches, et cetera, and also the area below and above the roadway, which is where a lot of the infrastructure supporting telecom is located, including street furniture like stoplights and other city-owned infrastructure like water towers. And the right-of-way is an extremely important asset for cities, and cities hold that asset in trust for residents, which means the protection in the active management and maintenance of the public right-of-way means that it's important for cities to process, adopt processes and ordinances to properly care for and manage that important asset. This often includes adopting fee schedules for permitting, rents to receive reimbursement for the use of that infrastructure in the public right-of-way, as well as compensation for placing equipment in the right-of-way or co-locating on certain city-owned structures. And when it comes to telecom infrastructure in the public right-of-way, one of the things that we're continuing to see is, as our telecom industry partners noted, is as technologies continue to become more advanced and pervasive, such as connected autonomous vehicle technology, the infrastructure needed to support the new technology, as well as the increased data consumption, also means a significant demand and increase for access and potentially a crowding of the right-of-way and street furniture. And our position is that it is incredibly important for the siting of that technology on city-owned infrastructure and managed assets to have a balanced approach that not only lets technology flourish, but also provides city authority to manage a crowded right-of-way, to maintain authority to review and control developments, and also to collect fair reimbursement for use and access to the right-of-way and city assets that telecommunications providers seek to access. Talking a little bit about wireless infrastructure deployment and the infrastructure deployment that you see here, much like the macro cells on the City of Skylines water tower there on the left-hand side, or the small cells facility on a city pole in Minneapolis, are dependent on robust networks of fiber backhaul. With this type of technology, you can't necessarily have wireless without the wires. And this means that permitting and engineering review is so important from a city perspective to ensure public safety and manage the right-of-way effectively. Infrastructure siting is governed, as Mr. Eliff mentioned, by local, state, and federal law. And it's important to note that there are broad preemptions on city authority in place at both the federal levels with the FCC regulations and rulings, as well as state law. And 5G deployment certainly carries with it a lot of exciting opportunities, much of what was mentioned before, but also from a city perspective, a lot of concerns with the density of those facility deployments necessary to support that new technology. And with wireless internet service providers having virtually unfettered access to the public right-of-way, it's really important for local governments to manage that authority to manage assets, as well as ensure that with a massive increase in small cell wireless facilities, that we continue to be able to manage the asset. Just wanted to briefly touch on broadband. Can you still see that, Mr. Chair?
I can. And Mr. Lightfoot, while you're doing that, I just want to let you know that we're running out a little out of time here.
Yeah.
So wrap up in the next minute.
Yep. I will absolutely wrap up. We talked a little bit about broadband already. Certainly there are barriers that still exist for municipal broadband. And then just lastly, wanted to touch on cable franchising. We are seeing some concerning trends with cord cutting, and as there's a precipitous drop in broadband cable subscriptions, we are losing a little bit of revenue from a city perspective with that 5% franchise fee, and that puts a lot of our PEG programming at risk for public access television. So there could be policy considerations to update the franchising authority to reflect new technologies. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll conclude my presentation and stand for any questions.
Thank you very much. There are a few questions. We have just about 5 or 10 minutes here before we move on to the liquor realm. I do have a question to begin with, and maybe Mr. Christensen, this might be best for you. I know there's been some news recently about 911 outages in some parts of rural Minnesota, particularly in southern Minnesota. I wonder if you had any comment about what's going on there, or could help us understand what's happening with our state's 911 system.
I probably am not the best person to answer that. I know that there was an outage in southeast Minnesota but I don't know any of the specifics or any. I can tell you that we've been working with Emergency Communications Network at DPS on transitioning to next gen 911. And other than the network side of it, I don't know that I'm the best person. I certainly can find somebody and get to you.
Great. It looks like Ms. Bailey might have an answer to that too. So, and I'm sorry to put you on the spot about that, Mr. Christensen. But
that's right.
No, it's our network. Yes, there were some intermittent outages that occurred. I don't have all the information in front of me right now, but I can get you sort of the information of what happened, how we fixed it, when we fixed it, the calls that came in, info like that. I mean, that's, but right now I wouldn't be able to give you any detailed info that you're looking for, like what the cause was, or most oftentimes it's weather. Sometimes it has something to do with the equipment that we have, either it needs to be replaced or repaired. But yeah, I will definitely get you that info.
Thank you, Ms. Bailey. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it wasn't a question that I had, just more of a comment. So back when I used to teach college, voice and data communications was one of the courses I taught. And I just wanted to provide some feedback that I am absolutely fascinated and in love the background. You know, it's about 100, you know, approximately, let's say 75 year history of the voice network anyway. And probably a few longer. But then how that over the years, right, there has been a necessity for regulation in these areas. But then the evolution as the decades have progressed, what we've seen here, a migration from voice communications to data communications and a heavy reliance on that. And it's very important that we as policymakers are cognizant of these regulations that had their place at one point in time. But as innovation has occurred over the decades, how they might actually be acting as a hindrance in the modern voice and data communication networks. And I think it's very important to, as we just heard there with the league testifying, people cutting the cord. So you have the voice communications, and then you have the coax, which is the cable network infrastructures, the copper infrastructures, but most of that stuff is slowly migrating to IP-based, Internet Protocol-based. So I can get my same traditional cable content, cable news content, over an IP network. So why would I want it? Why do I need to be a subscriber to cable per se, unless it's my ISP for broadband? But anyway, fascinating. And then huge kudos, and I commend the industry. In this COVID era here, we saw just an overnight ramp up of the demand and the strain placed on the network, and how the technology providers were able to keep up with the working remote, the distance learning, and the incredible, again, strain on the network. And there were some noticeable latency in the beginning, but that was accommodated for very quickly. And as we continue, nearly every product that we as consumers are buying today comes with a network interface or a wireless interface of some kind, whether it be the refrigerators, the thermostats, the remote garage door, the deadbolt on the front door, the automobiles, right? Is your automobile connected to your wireless network? All of these things, the Internet of Things, creates an ever-increasing demand on the network, and it's just such an incredible time to live in, and I'm one of those people that just gets an adrenaline rush whenever these conversations take place. So thank you so much, and I look forward to the continued innovations and what we as policymakers can do to help bring a better and more stable and reliable and fast network to all of Minnesota. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. And thank you also for another trip into your employment history. I feel like we're getting an overview of all the jobs that Representative Lucero has had, which are diverse. I mean, I don't know if you've had more jobs or you have more colorful suit coats. It's one of those two. I'm not sure.
It would be a tough one to, yes. It's,
yeah, animal control officer all the way to college professor. It's quite
there. There we go.
Representative Haley.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. I have a question. Maybe this is directed towards either Mr. Wirtz or Mr. Fusik regarding just the the 5G opportunity that is ahead for us. Is there anything that the state can do to aid that implementation?
Mr. Wirtz, Mr. Fusick, who wants to go first on that?
Sure, Representative Haley. I'll go first, Patrick.
Go ahead, Paul.
Chair Stevenson, Representative Haley. I'll give you a real good example. My colleague, Mr. Lightfoot's on the call here, the hearing as well. In the era of pandemic, you know, really it's about the conversations with local government and sharing your plans for investment. And two, I will cite two that I think are great examples of how this gets done and how we get this 5G rolled out. I talked about some of the announcements we've made in the past year, 5G sub six. But the city of Woodbury, over the summer, my colleague Valerie Bergman worked very closely with the city of Woodbury in a time where, you know, City Hall was closed. We've had some coverage areas issues out there. It's a lot of growth, a lot of houses going up over there. And really, it was the old-fashioned way, conversations, emails. The city didn't even really have an ordinance to kind of enable the deployment of this. And, you know, by midsummer, we got 8 permits approved, and we're on our way. The other one that I think is, you know, I would put the city of Minneapolis up against any large municipality in the country. We meet with their traffic manager that really authorizes the permits on a weekly basis with the city of Minneapolis. We talk about where the small cell permits need to go. We talk about the connection of power. We've had some issues we need to resolve. It's a conversation. You know, it's part of that 100-year history of respecting that we're in the right of way. We're a partner with local government. And I think that really helps in deploying that 5G.
Mr. Fusick, if you have anything brief to add.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, I would just add, I think I mentioned in my last comment on my testimony, which is commending the state for passing the 5G small cell legislation when you did a few years ago. Again, that has provided a uniform, stable environment for which we are going to go out and deploy all carriers. You know, it doesn't treat anybody differently. It's not discriminatory. And I think the key part of that is I didn't work on the Minnesota bill directly, but I've worked in about 7 other states and directly with the municipal leagues in those states. And, you know, it was a brand new kind of concept to everybody. And I just want to say that, you know, from an industry perspective, I'm just, not just T-Mobile, but we, once you pass some legislation, there's things that we need to get back and follow up and work with them on. We're open to doing that. And I think, you know, this opportunity provides itself with regards to the new statute. And, you know, the bottom line is that we, you know, it's because it's what we have in statute, there's something we need to change. We can work with the cities to do that as well. And we find ourselves to be in a pretty good situation where we continue to partner with cities across the country. If something's not exactly covered in one of the statutes that we passed, work with them, not outside the statutory boundaries, of course, but just addressing issues that maybe sometimes you have to come back and change the statute to address some of those concerns that came up. So I think the foundation that you all have now with regards to the 5G legislation in place is going to help. And just one last point from a T-Mobile perspective is, you know, the dense urban area of St. Paul, Minnesota, where you're going to need your 5G small cells is one component of what we deploy. But also, obviously, our macro sites are what we're deploying across the whole state is really how we'll deliver a good portion of our network there because of the spectrum assets that we have. So I just point out that I think the Minnesota law is working there as well, and we haven't had any major issues. So just want to commend you for being, as Representative Lucero said, it's tough to keep track of technology. I mean, legislation always takes a little bit longer to keep up with technology, and it's just evolving so quickly. So I think you've all done a great job, and, you know, you've got a great broadband presence there, and look forward to working with you to continue that trajectory.
Thank you.
Well, and thank you very much to all of our Representative Elkins, if you could keep it relatively brief here.
Very brief. One of my concerns is looking a few years into the future in this tension between the carriers and the cities is that as shared autonomous vehicles come onto the landscape, it's going to be very important for cities to be able to control the curb. And I'm foreseeing, you know, potential conflicts between, you know, where cities are going to need to locate pick up and drop off points for passengers and where 5G cabinets need to be put. And is anybody starting to, you know, any of the industry or in the city starting to think about how we're going to resolve that conflict say, 5 to 10 years from now?
That's a big question, and if anyone has a brief answer, because I do want to leave time for liquor, but does someone have a brief answer to that question, Mr. Lightfoot?
Mr. Chair, Representative Elkins, certainly I think what Mr. Wiertz mentioned in terms of continuing conversations between the city and industry providers that are putting in the technology to support new technologies, I think will be crucial. We have Mayor Jason Gadd, who serves on the Governor's Connected Autonomous Vehicles Task Force, that provides the voice of local government on that task force as we start to think about policies necessary to both preserve city authority to manage the public right-of-way, while, as I said, letting that technology to flourish. So I think it's going to necessitate open lines of communication and working together to make sure we come to a solution.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Lightfoot, and thank you, Representative Elkins. Sorry, that is an excellent question. I want to make sure that we have enough time to get to the liquor issue. So thank you to all of our telecommunications testifiers. We look forward to working with you throughout the session. Our next agenda item will be to look at our state's liquor laws, which, of course, is a central area of this committee's jurisdiction, and undoubtedly a lot of interest in the committee relates to that. So we are going to have House Research do a presentation, after which if members have questions for Mr. Klayman, they can offer them. So Mr. Klayman, if the floor is yours.
Sure, and thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for the record, my name is Chris Klayman. I'm from the House Research Department. For the most part, I staff the area of taxes, but this is one non-tax area that I staff. So I'm one of the liquor analysts here in the House Research Department. I say one of the liquor analysts because the director of House Research, Patrick McCormick, on occasion also handles liquor issues, and that's our contact information there. And feel free to reach out to me or to Patrick if you have any questions, any legal questions or policy questions in the liquor area, or you need us to draft a bill or an amendment or even help you develop legislation. We're always happy to do that. This is going to be, my intent here is to, like my colleague, Mr. Eliff, is to provide, you know, a pretty high level overview of the regulatory system of liquor in the state of Minnesota. And I thought it'd be good to get into just a little bit some of the history that has gone into the establishment of the liquor system in the way that it is today. There's not a whole lot of history in this presentation, but I did dig into it a little bit. Because that's the history really informs the type of system that we have today. And I think it can provide some context to understand a little bit more on a maybe a deeper level, you know, where the bills that come through the Commerce Committee are coming from and what the implications are. I thought, though, I'd start, though, just with some basic definitions in case there are people on the committee that have never been on the committee before, in case anybody just wants a refresher. There can be some definitional differences between the way that, you know, we often use, you know, words in colloquial speech, I guess, and the way that they're actually defined in the liquor chapter. So just as a review and to point some of these out, I guess at the outset, the first thing I'd say is that the liquor chapter, it's chapter 340A, and it's called the liquor chapter. And so what that means is that the word liquor typically encompasses, you know, when people in my world say it, typically encompasses beer, wine, and distilled spirits. So all three of them. Sometimes people think liquor just refers to distilled spirits, but not necessarily the case. So it's just a good idea to check the definitions that are used in state statute. Technically, Chapter 340A, it regulates alcoholic beverages. So anything less than 0.5% alcohol by volume, so, you know, kombucha, near beer, that's not going to fall under Chapter 340A, even though some of those products do contain small amounts of alcohol. Malt liquor, that's what the state calls beer, and that includes both 3.2 and strong beer. The definition of wine, that's again, not one that's going to surprise too many people, except it does include cider, and so there can be some policy implications there, especially in the tax area. distilled spirits, again, pretty much what you think, whiskey, rum, brandy, gin, et cetera. And then quickly, off sale and on sale. Off sale liquor is liquor that's sold for consumption off the premises where you buy it. So you're going to buy it, you're going to take it away. On sale is the opposite. You're going to purchase the alcoholic beverage for consumption on the premises. Okay, so more of a high level view here. The federal government doesn't have much of a role in regulating liquor. It does play some role, but by and large, liquor regulation is a state issue, and that's because the 21st Amendment of the Constitution grants states significant authority to regulate their own liquor system. And so most states have taken advantage of that and have their own systems for liquor regulation. What that means is that if you are going to sell liquor in Minnesota, you have to comply with all Minnesota liquor laws. And that includes e-commerce or internet sales. So for instance, you can't ship liquor into the state from an out-of-state liquor store unless you do it in a way that complies with the state liquor regulations. If you're an internet retailer of liquor, you probably have to be partnering with a local liquor store or operating under an exception that exists in state law to do that. So that's an important thing to keep in mind. There's a sub bullet in bullet two. This is a standard idea. Liquor must come to rest with a licensed wholesaler. That has to do with importation. And importation is really, that's really the area where states exert the most authority. And so for instance, states can have a significant role to play in the shipment of liquor in interstate commerce. And there's the federal government doesn't really regulate interstate shipments in liquor. I actually called the TTB and the ATF a few years ago when I was researching publication. They told me, yeah, we just don't deal with this. It's a state issue. So, so by and large, states enforce their own liquor laws and their own importation laws. This power to regulate essentially impact interstate commerce and liquor, this is not a power that any state has really in a lot of other areas of legislation because of the Commerce Clause. And because of the way that the Commerce Clause has been interpreted over the years by the United States Supreme Court. So the state's authority to regulate liquor, it's pretty extraordinary. That being said, there still are some constitutional limits that the federal courts at the Supreme Court of the United States have put in place. A couple of the big cases down on the bottom, no reason to know the names of them, but Bacchus and Granholm. Bacchus was a tax case, but essentially what those cases say is that a state cannot favor its own domestic manufacturers of liquor at the expense of out-of-state manufacturers of liquor. So you can't favor an in-state economic interest, and that's a pretty foundational proposition in the Supreme Court's Interstate Commerce Clause jurisprudence. But there is this tension between state authority under the 21st Amendment and the limitations that the federal courts have put on liquor through the Commerce Clause. And that's a tension that exists to this day. And there's actually a recent a case from last year on this very issue in Minnesota that affects Minnesota's farm winery law, which I have a slide on that later. So we can, that'll be discussed later. But okay, a little bit of history. The pre-prohibition era, I won't go too far into this, but one of the main concerns in the pre-prohibition era, this is, prior to 1920, tied houses. Tied houses were retailers that were either owned by or had exclusive relationships with producers, usually beer producers. And so these saloons, most of them were saloons, they had a significant incentive that they were getting from the person who had the ownership interest in them, typically the producer, to oversell, to sell as much liquor as possible. And I put a quote up here from I think 1933, about the danger of tied houses. This was the perspective at the time. You know, the last couple of sentences, the manufacturer knew nothing and cared nothing about the community. All he wanted was increased sales. So that was seen as a problem in the pre-prohibition era. And in these tied houses, they were vertically integrated. And so, of course, again, I think this is roughly the same time that, you know, antitrust law was being developed, and there was a significant amount of attention at the federal level on things like vertical integration, horizontal integration. So these were vertically integrated businesses. The perception was is that they were somewhat damaging. There's another quote here. There was obviously a big perception of social harm. And so I put a quote down there, which you can read. I won't read it. But again, one of the just an example, I think, of the common perspective at the time. The idea that essentially the liquor the liquor industry caused social harm. It was being driven by the profit motive. I'll go through these slides pretty quick. The thing to keep in mind from just a legal history standpoint, when it comes to the regulation of liquor, is that as far back as the late 1800s, states have been trying to regulate liquor. And some states wanted to be dry, some wanted to be a little more restrictive. Some states wanted to control the type of alcohol that was coming in, or wanted to control the liquor that was being imported into their states. And they were getting shot down by the federal courts. Was one of the problems. So the Wilson Act was passed in 1890. And the idea behind the Wilson Act was, allow states to ban imports of liquor. But the Supreme Court a few years later said, well, we're not really going to force that because technically the liquor can still be received. So you can't import it, but it can be received. Well, that kind of hollowed that statute out. So to fix the Wilson Act, in 1913, Congress passed the Webb-Kenyon Act to shore that up and say, no, this time we really mean it. That didn't last very long. The Supreme Court ended up still allowing or said that states couldn't prohibit importation of liquor if they allowed it for personal use. So then Congress had to pass something called the Reed Act. I don't have a slide on that. After the Webb-Kenyon Act to shore up the Webb-Kenyon Act. So there was this almost like a branch conflict between Congress and the federal courts. Congress kept trying to allow states the authority to regulate liquor, and the federal courts kept saying, well, no, you can't, not under the Commerce Clause. This is the 18th Amendment, Section 1. This is the amendment that prohibited liquor. One thing to keep in mind with the 18th Amendment language is that it doesn't ban purchase, and it doesn't ban consumption. And so there were some holes in prohibition, according to some scholars. It didn't quite lock everything down. For instance, basically allows de facto home production. Well, technically illegal to produce it, but very difficult to enforce. And of course, if you're consuming it, are you violating the 18th Amendment? Maybe, maybe not. Second bullet point, this is interesting, uses the phrase intoxicating liquors and not alcoholic beverages. There's some scholarship that suggests that this spawned a lot of arguments about, is beer intoxicating liquor or isn't it? And, I think that's probably the right context to see the state's 3-2 laws. And 3-2, and I have a slide on 3-2 coming up in the presentation. It's not actually defined as intoxicating liquor. I think that probably reflects maybe some of these conversations that were happening back, 80, 90 years ago. I thought I'd just throw in a quick bullet on the Volstead Act, because Volstead Act is named after Andrew Volstead. He was a congressman from Minnesota. He was born in Goodhue County. He's an Ole. He went to St. Olaf College. And the Volstead Act was the act that really implemented on an administrative level the 18th Amendment. As everyone knows, prohibition was seen not to work. There were a lot of concerns raised about, in order to enforce it, you had to really intrude on people's personal space, personal behavior. And there was some, I think, some uncomfortability with that. There was also some concern about, you know, the severity of this from an economic regulation standpoint. And, you know, there is in 1920, when prohibition took effect, at the same time, you had communism arising in the Soviet Union. And so I think there was probably, or according to some scholars, there was some reason to question the extent to which prohibition was a real severe impairment on the use of private property. Of course, other reasons for that are commonly understood against prohibition is that it wasn't working. I mean, there were still a lot of people who were drinking. It didn't really solve a problem. Organized crime, obviously, product safety, bathtub gin, you know, the whole problem with unregulated liquor. On the other hand, I did find some interesting research questioning some of those, at least some of those conventional wisdom on, you know, why prohibition ended. The second bullet point, there's at least an argument, there's an argument that consumption actually did go down by a significant amount because prices went up. So especially among working class people who maybe couldn't afford to pay the extra, that's the speculation at least. Some other myths, people may have drank less. As far as organized crime goes, well, they were already organized by that time, so not necessarily the cause of organized crime. As far as alcohol poisoning from, you know, bad alcohol, well, it maybe didn't really expand very much during prohibition. Another reason, maybe the biggest reason why prohibition ended is there was the Great Depression, of course, and a federal liquor tax was seen as a potential area of raising revenue that was badly needed in 1933. So prohibition was repealed in 1933. Section 2, again, this is basically the Webb-Kenyon Act. So here's the question coming out of prohibition. What do you do now that prohibition's not there anymore? How do you address the problems of the pre-prohibition era and also address some of the problems of prohibition? So that's what created our current liquor system in our state and other states. And it's, I think it's important to note that Section 2 is really intended to be a restatement of the Webb-Kenyon Act and is intended to provide states with that broad authority to regulate liquor. So the 21st Amendment, the effect that it had is that federal control was devolved to the states. And there are a couple of different ways that states then went about regulating their own liquor systems. There's control states where the state controls sale and distribution or some aspect of those two elements of the liquor industry. Another system that was developed is the three-tier system. And the three-tier system, that's in modified form, that's the system that we have in Minnesota. And I'll spend just a little time on this. In a pure three-tier system, each tier is separately licensed and regulated. And the manufacturers only sell to wholesalers, and those wholesalers only sell to retailers, and those retailers only sell to consumers. And they're not supposed to mix. So no manufacturers can be wholesalers, et cetera. So this solves the vertical integration problem. That's one of the pre-prohibition era problems. No more tied houses, because now a producer cannot have an interest in a retailer. A wholesale tier, that middle tier, also allows for tax administration. So we have a liquor excise tax in state law. And with all the liquor coming to rest with a liquor wholesaler, you have a centralized place to keep track of and tax, impose that liquor excise tax. There's some other reasons that typically are raised in support of the three-tier system, safety, fairness, greater control of social conditions. I guess I'd just say on that, a neighborhood with a bar is different than a neighborhood that doesn't have a bar. So where do the bars, you know, where should they go? Where should we put them? You know, those are issues that states and also cities, of course, municipalities typically want to have some control over. So that's in general, that's what a three-tier system does. In the state in the 1970s, there's this act called the Coleman Act, named after the Senate Majority Leader at the time in the Minnesota legislature, that essentially reaffirmed the three-tier system and balanced a number of different interests. A version of that Coleman Act three-tier system exists to this day. Probably best to describe the Minnesota system of liquor regulation as a modified three-tier system. It's not a pure three-tier system. And the reason is that the three-tier system allows for a significant number of exceptions. On this, really the small producer side of the industry, not surprising to anybody who's, you know, been paying attention the last 10 or 20 years, there's a lot of microbreweries, micro distilleries, et cetera. And so our liquor laws reflect that. And so it's a modified system. Again, the conventional wisdom in providing exceptions to the three-tier system is that the three-tier system imposes regulatory costs, burdens, which may impose barriers to entry. So if you're trying to stimulate, you know, a local small-scale, small producer industry, which is where a lot of the market trends have been going in the past, you know, 10 or 20 years, the theory is as well, maybe they need some relief from the system, from the regulations. And so what that means is that small producers are sometimes allowed to wholesale, sometimes they're allowed to also sell on and off sale liquor, which again, in a pure three-tier system wouldn't be allowed. So they're allowed to have a certain amount of vertical integration, but only up to a point. So the exceptions to the three-tier system are not absolute. There are limits. I thought I'd go through, I think I have enough time. Yeah, just really the three main exceptions, or the exceptions for three main industries. First is micro distilleries. And I'll go through some of the main exceptions here, regulatory exceptions. And by the way, I'm certainly happy to answer any questions as we go, or however the chair wants to do it, of course. But for micro distilleries, they get their exceptions until they reach a certain size. So the limit is 40,000 proof gallons per year. Once you produce more than 40,000 proof gallons of distilled spirits, you can no longer do some of the things that you see on the last two bullet points, which is sell on sale liquor at a cocktail room or sell off sale liquor that's produced on site. And for that off sale retail authority, they're limited to a smaller size bottle than the typical bottle that you buy at a liquor store. So it's one 375 milliliter bottle per customer per day of their product that's produced on site.
And Mr. Clement, I'm sorry, I wasn't able to hit unmute quickly enough to answer to your point about questions, but we will do questions at the end of your presentation. Just as a heads up, both to you and the members, we do have a hard stop at 4:30. So you could leave, try and finish just a little before 4:30 so we have enough time for some member questions. That'd be great.
Yep, that's definitely doable, Mr. Chair. So, I don't think I have too many more slides. Continuing on with microbreweries, there is no statutory definition of a microbrewery. In the application that you fill out with the state of Minnesota, with the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division, they call a microbrewery a brewery that brews 2,000 barrels or less per year. Otherwise, there's nothing in statute saying what a microbrewery is. And really, instead, what we have in the state is we have really two categories of beer producers. So we have brew pubs and breweries. And so I'll just get in a little bit to what these two categories of producers can do. Starting with brew pubs, they can manufacture their own beer and they can sell that on sale. So they can sell their own product, which again, under a strict three-tier system, they couldn't do that. Brew pubs can also sell off-sale beer and growlers. They're subject to some limitations that breweries aren't, 750 barrel limitations, et cetera. The big thing that a brew pub can do, however, is they can also get a full on-sale intoxicating liquor license. So they can get the same liquor license that a bar can get, essentially. The trade-off there is they can't sell to wholesalers. So they can't wholesale their beer. So brewers, by contrast, they can also sell on-sale beer at a tap room. The limit there is 250,000 barrels a year. If you go over 250,000 barrels, you can't sell beer at a tap room. At this point, there's no Minnesota brewery that's hit that. It's a pretty high limit. Brewers can also sell beer and growlers off sale. Again, the limit there is 20,000 barrels. If you produce more than 20,000 barrels a year, you can no longer sell your beer and growlers if you're a brewery. Also, one of the things that a brewer can do, they can also self-distribute, meaning they can wholesale. So they can wholesale their beer, restaurants, et cetera, until they hit that 20,000 barrel a year limit. And then they can't do it anymore. Then they have to sell to a licensed distributor. There's an exception for one brewery in state law, but probably not necessary to go over it. Here's the other thing. At a tap room, a brewer cannot get a full on-sale intoxicating liquor license. So they cannot do what a brew pub can do. Again, the trade-off there is your ability to wholesale. So that's really the big trade-off between a brewer and a brew pub, is your ability to wholesale. Farm wineries, I do want to get to this for sure. They have a lot of independent authority outside the three-tier system. They can on-sale their wine, they can off-sale their wine, they can self-distribute, they can also get a full on-sale intoxicating liquor license, but the trade-offs are they have to be operated by the owner of a Minnesota farm, and they have to be located on agricultural land. There is another provision in state law which is not enforceable as of September of last year, which is that the majority of the ingredients by a farm winery that go into their wine must be grown in Minnesota. The District Court of Minnesota, I guess last August, actually held that that's not enforceable under the Commerce Clause. So again, here's this tension between state authority under the 21st Amendment and the federal courts imposing restrictions on that authority through the Commerce Clause. So the court ordered an injunction against the enforcement of this particular farm winery requirement. And that was a district court decision, although it was not appealed. So far as I know, unless there's something different out there that I'm not aware of, that injunction is still in effect. So essentially that 51% Minnesota grown requirement for farm wineries is not enforceable. 3-2, a little bit on 3-2. I don't have to spend too much time on this. Basically, Minnesota is the last state with 3-2 laws. Again, as I mentioned before, it's not defined as intoxicating liquor. A lot of the provisions that apply to intoxicating liquor still apply to 3-2, but you have to do so specifically. Certain labeling requirements there. There's some interesting ways that 3-2 is defined. And so again, one of the questions that's come up in recent years as well, is there going to be 3-2 to sell in the state? And basically 3-2 is much more lightly regulated than strong beer and other kinds of intoxicating liquor. And so that's why you can buy it at places other than a liquor store. Quick note on local authority. There is a lot of local authority to regulate liquor. For instance, Muni's, a municipal liquor store, that's basically a local monopoly on off-sale liquor. Can probably be more restrictive. There is a Minnesota Court of Appeals case that, you know, maybe raises some doubt on that, but probably local municipalities can be more restrictive if they want. It could be dry, I think, if they wanted to. They also, of course, issue a lot of the on and off sale licenses for bars, restaurants, and liquor stores. Enforcement, there's a few bullet points there. Basically, the commissioner of public safety and local licensing jurisdictions, they can enforce these laws through suspending and revoking licenses. There's also other ordinances, criminal, civil liability. And then I should mention too that the alcohol and gambling enforcement is the division of the Department of DPS that at the state level handles the administration of the state's liquor law. So they also conduct investigations, inspections, issue fines. One other characteristic of Minnesota's regulatory system is we require retailers of alcoholic beverages to obtain dram shop liability insurance. And that's basically for personal injury cases. Again, doesn't apply to certain 3-2 retailers and others if they're really, really small operations. Getting close to the end here. Recent legislation in the state in the liquor area, Sunday sales, that was a big one, passed in 2017. I think another one I'd mention is there was a COVID pandemic bill that did allow restaurants to make limited off sales of beer and wine, also hard seltzer and cider, which again, they can't do, have an on sale license, not an off sale license. So they needed special authority to do that. And that applies when those restaurants sell takeout orders of prepared food. There's another thing that often comes up in the Commerce Committee, usually integrated into the liquor bill, and that's a lot of special laws for local jurisdictions. So for instance, the 2020 Omnibus Liquor Bill, I think there were 14 separate municipalities that had small discrete exceptions to the liquor laws. And you know, often it's an exception for a particular circumstance, which is a technical violation of state law. At times though too, the legislature has authorized local jurisdictions to violate their own zoning ordinances. Because it can sometimes be easier to get a exception from the state from your own zoning ordinances than it is to actually go through the process of changing them. If you want more information, check the House Research website. We got a lot of publications there. You can look up special liquor laws historically. And that, Mr. Chair, concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Klayman. We do have a couple members on the list for questions, and we have about 8 minutes, so members, we probably could take additional questions if people have them. First is Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is maybe more closed captioned to you and to Mr. Klayman. Thank you for your presentation today, sir. Mr. Chair, one of the things that I think that this committee maybe could benefit from is as we start getting into bills and maybe before we start hearing some in the liquor area, would be some more conversation about the history of what did we do before we had tap houses? How do we regulate liquor? How do we work with those kinds of things? Because I suspect that we are going to be getting a number of requests if members' mailboxes and phones are the same as mine, people wanting to expand the liquor, wanting to change the laws, wanting to get rid of the three-tier system, wanting to, I'm oversimplifying, roll the marbles their direction versus the direction that they're rolling right now in the industry. I would like to dig deeper into this and maybe, and Mr. Chair, if we could have a worker group that's a result of this as a subset of the Commerce Committee so that we can come back, because this is an issue that plagues this committee year after year, ever since I've been here and long before I've been here. And hopefully we can put this in a direction where we're putting people in a win-win situation. It seems like it's good for a while, but then as the industry grows or as things change, we're constantly dealing with it. I know that's something we have to do, but it seems a little counterproductive to be continuing to deal with it year after year after year. Maybe a delving into the system and looking at this. It's your call, Mr. Chair, but just closed caption to you.
Well, Representative Driscoll, I appreciate the comments and the suggestion, and I tend to agree with you that there's a lot to unpack under our state's current liquor law, and a lot of discussion that needs to occur in order to find a workable solution to, I think, a lot of the pressures that industry players and, as a consequence, members are feeling. And as I've indicated to anyone who's talked to me about liquor in the last few weeks, between the pandemic and the budget process this year, I question, and the fact that we're operating remotely, I do question our capacity to have the kind of discussion that I think that we need to have, and the kind that you just kind of alluded to would be very helpful in order to have that liquor conversation. So we will take a look at what our schedule will allow this year and how the session develops. And rest assured that I share your view that a lot of context is necessary and a lot of discussions are necessary in order to have a productive and constructive conversation about liquor.
Mr. Chair, just one more thing to think about.
That's an address comment.
Who thought liquor would be controversial, number one? And then number two would be maybe this is a good interim activity to be able to have this committee look at. I don't know that there may be some local municipal kinds of things that we may want to take up in an omnibus bill, but if we're looking at a larger bill that will affect the long run in the state of Minnesota, maybe a good interim committee work on this or subset and bringing the full committee in so that we're ready in February or March of next year when we reconvene. Again, your call, my thoughts on the matter.
Well, Representative Driscoll, I always appreciate your advice. And, you know, I do think, I suspect that every member on this Zoom ran for the legislature in order to make liquor laws. I mean, that's, I think, the whole reason why people become state legislators. I certainly wouldn't foreclose the possibility of having a discussion or work on liquor during our session this year if we happen to have the capacity or an agreement between the stakeholders is reached. But I do think that in the event that that doesn't materialize, that an interim conversation also would be very appropriate. And we'll certainly be coordinating with you as we look to that. Representative Katisa Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have my video off simply because I'm having some bandwidth issues here at home today. So I apologize for that. But I am hopeful that Mr. Kleeman can maybe give us a little bit more context. I saw on some of the slides the opportunity for some of the different types of businesses to scale up or purchase or apply for a full on-site liquor license. And I'm just curious what the change in fees looks like for that. And I think that, you know, many members of the public don't necessarily have all the detail and the nuance of our liquor law system here. And so I'm curious what that looks like for individual businesses. And if you could shed a little light on that, please.
Mr. Kling.
Sure. Yep. Mr. Chair, Representative. So on the on-sale license fees, I believe most of those are going to be set by the local licensing jurisdictions. And so, for instance, the city of Minneapolis has different tiers. If there are, you know, nightclubs where there's dancing, you know, it's a certain amount of money, and then 3-2, it's going to be lower than that. So that's typically those are going to be local decisions.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just am curious if in certain situations, different businesses may feel like they're priced out of kind of scaling up. And so I was just looking for that additional information. Maybe we can look at it at the county level or even the city level later on in the year.
All right. And I don't see any other members seeking recognition. And we are approaching the magic hour of 4:30. So we will call that a day, and we'll be back next week to look at gaming. Until then, the committee is adjourned.